Remembering My Mother, Marian Ethel Crenk Sloan. My mother was born on June 16, 1919 in Minnesota, believe St. Paul and died in Columbia, MO on August 19, 1987. She and my dad, Floyd Arthur Sloan, are buried in Memorial Park Cemetery in Columbia, MO. Her parents were Ben and Ethel Dunlap Crenk. She was tall, blonde, and excelled at anything she tried. She had a younger sister Dorothy and two older brothers Douglas and Benjamin, who later changed his name to Andre Bainey. Her mom died, I believe suicide, when she in her teens. Her death was devastating to my mom, and she never really talked to me about that part of her life. After her death, I believe she left home unsure of when and went to live with her mom's sister Laura, in Sioux City, La. This is where she met my dad, and they married 3 days after they met. Her life between her mom's death and marrying my dad is unknown to me and rarely discussed. I'm pretty sure she didn't finish HS yet, was very intelligent and an outstanding writer. After I was born on March 28, 1938, she could not have any more children. My name came from my dad Floyd Arthur and one of Aunt Laura's two sons, one named Russell, therefore Floyd Russell Sloan. My mom had a great sense of humor, loved crossword puzzles, and whatever she chose to do, she excelled. When my mom and dad built a story and a half home all by themselves, my mom did the lion's share of the work. She could sheetrock, lay hardwood floors, frame a wall, you name it. She also was an excellent seamstress, good cook, although she was not into cooking and probably could have written professionally. When I was in grade school, the night before Easter, she would write elaborate rhyming poems as to where the next Easter basket would be located. She had a keen interest in politics, and both my mom and dad were staunch Republicans. My mom had a terrific whistle, and as a kid I could go play as far away as I could hear her whistle. She played the piano, and later she played the organ at Church St. Andrews in Columbia, MO. As a boy growing up, it was always reassuring to come home from school and my mom would be there, good day or bad. She was always encouraging of my interests and efforts, although I'm sure she wished I had some musical ability, which I had none. She liked to bowl and probably would have loved to have played golf, but we did not have the money for her to do that, and she did not get her driver's license until she was in her 40s. During World War II, my parents kept my dad's brother Jack Sloan, little girl Linda Sloan, after my dad's brother got a divorce and went off to war. Linda was 3 years younger than me, and I loved her as if she had been my sister, and my parents loved her immensely. When I was in the first grade, my mom, Linda, and me went to visit my mom's dad in Columbia, MO. We rode with Dorothy and her husband, who she soon divorced after learning that he was wearing military medals and ribbons that he had not earned. Never found out what happened to him. Don't know if Dorothy got a divorce or annulment. The trip to Columbia was in May of 1945, and my dad stayed behind to work. The Germans had surrendered in Europe, but the war in the Pacific was still raging. During our visit, my parents decided to stay in Columbia, and my dad sold our possessions and joined us in Columbia. We drove my dad's brother's car, 1938 Olds, built like a tank, while he was in Europe. He was in the 101st Airborne and fought at Bastogne, the last desperate massive offensive launched by Hitler. Fortunately, he came back safely. All the years I grew up, my mom stayed at home. Only after HS did she go to work at Boone County National Bank. When she did finally get her driver's license in her 40s, she would then drive most anywhere. She had a lead foot on the interstate but did not like to drive that much in city traffic. For a good many years we had but one vehicle, but when my mom finally got her license, she drove a Buick, and the bigger the better. She bought one used Buick that was sold to her as a one-owner car. We had suspicions about that, and she had a friend on the highway patrol that researched the vehicle and found that there were multiple owners and that the mileage had been turned back. The auto dealership was caught with their pants down and paid my mom $26,000 to settle their fraud. In 1959, after we beat Kansas for the Orange Bowl bid, Peg and I decided to get married and she could go to the Orange Bowl as part of the official Missouri contingent. When I told my mom and dad of our plans, my mom was really upset. She felt I was too young, not quite 22, to get married. I suspected that maybe she felt that she was too young at 18 to have gotten married. She and my dad gave every indication that they were not coming to the wedding. But they did. They were initially suspicious that Peg had talked me into getting married, but that was totally wrong. I was the one who pushed getting married. After an initial period of coolness, my mom and Peg became great friends, as Peg had earned her respect, and that strong friendship would last until my mom's death in 1987. My parents were married for 48 years before my dad died. At times they had a verbally aggressive relationship. Both were strong-willed. But they both respected and loved each other, and as a team they accomplished a lot. My mom kept my dad's business books, and I'm sure she developed a system of bookkeeping unknown to any other bookkeeper. But it worked. Going back to 1946, when my dad's brother returned from the war and reclaimed his daughter, Linda, it left a huge void in my parents' lives. They worked hard to adopt a child and finally accomplished that through the Lutheran home in St. Louis when we adopted my sister Thonetta Toni Sloan when she was 6 weeks old. My mom was most always the discipline dispenser in our home. I only remember my dad spanking me one time when we were still living in LA. My dad spoiled Toni, and I think that caused a degree of friction between my mom and dad. Most of my genetic traits seem to have come from my mom's side in looks and skills. In my mom's later years, we were living in Fresno, and she would drive out by herself or with her boxer and spend several weeks with us. She was a joy to have. When she developed breast cancer, which evolved into bone cancer, it was a shock because we knew it was likely fatal. When my mom's cancer finally progressed to the point of no hope, she was in the hospice area of Boone County Hospital. Peg and our daughter Lori and her daughter Allison went to be with her, and I followed a few days later. During the initial days in the hospital, she was under heavy painkiller sedation but did tell God that he needed to give Jesus more responsibility. "He's been a good son," she said, "and he died of everything you asked." Fortunately, my mom had a great woman doctor who told us that she would give her whatever is necessary to keep her out of pain. When I arrived, she was in and out of heavy sedation. She was unable to communicate, but if I leaned over her bedside and said, "Give me a kiss," she would try to pucker her lips. We were there when she died, and I experienced a grief that I had never known. I loved her immensely, and for 67 years she had given me her unconditional love. By the time of her funeral, all I could think of was the very funny aspects of our life together. She was a very unique character that furnished us Marian moments that still keep us laughing. My mom and I were very close. I never once talked back to my mom or dad. She was there for me through successes and disappointments. When I ran for Congress, she would often come up and stay with our kids when Peg and I were on the campaign trail. It seems that her main meal for our kids was hamburger helper, sometimes overly spiced, as my mom was losing her taste buds. She died way too young at 68. But I could not have had a better mother, and she left me with memories that bring a smile to my face, and she had been a tremendous influence in my life. Remembering my dad, Floyd Arthur Sloan. My dad was born in Volin, South Dakota on December 8, 1907. He was the oldest of two sons, and he had six sisters. All dates and names are in the family Bible, written in Norwegian, which is now in possession of our oldest son Doug Sloan. My dad's father Ole J. Sloan, born in Norway July 11, 1870, was a farmer. And my dad told me that at one time his dad had the largest private orchard in South Dakota. My dad did not discuss a lot of his boyhood days, but I think being the oldest son on the farm, he worked very hard. He had to quit school after the 8th grade, not uncommon in those days to work full-time on the farm. I think my dad's father became an alcoholic in his later years, and he died the year before I was born. I'm guessing this may have put more pressure on my dad to keep the farm going. My dad's parents both died before I was born. My dad's mom Rika Iverson Sloan died in 1923. We do have the family trunk, which came from Norway in 1871. On the outside of the trunk it reads, "From Oslo, Norway to the Dakota Territory." Sloan in Norwegian was spelled Slan, but a double A in Norwegian is pronounced as an O. They arrived from Norway before Ellis Island existed, so not sure where their arrival point was in America. Also don't know what caused them to leave Norway or wind up in South Dakota. Currently, our second son, Matt, has the trunk in his possession. I have found info on the internet that states, there is a Slan Farms in Norway and most Norwegians that came to America from this area settled in Minnesota and the Dakotas. At some point my dad found his way into the grocery store business in Sioux City, Iowa. He was in the Iowa National Guard for several years prior to World War II. He met my mom in Sioux City and I think it was at the grocery store owned by my mom's Aunt Laura and her husband C.S. Van Eaton. I do know they married 3 days after they met. My dad was 30 and my mom was 18. My dad loved to tell the story of dancing to Lawrence Welk, nationally known polka band leader and accordion player, and relating that the smart money boys in Sioux City said Lawrence would never make it. Welk had a very popular TV show in the 1950s and 60s which can still be found on cable TV today, 2015. I'm not sure exactly sure how long we lived in Sioux City before my dad took a grocery job in Grand Island, Nebraska, and I think it was also a store owned by my mom's aunt and her husband. We moved from there to Los Angeles in late 1941. My mom said that after Pearl Harbor was attacked that my dad's National Guard unit was called up, but as they gave my dad his physical prior to being shipped out they found he had 2 ruptured eardrums and rejected him. My mom said he literally cried for 3 days as his buddies were going and he couldn't join them. Our move to LA occurred shortly after that, but I'm unsure what took them to LA other than my dad. Had a sister there, Louise Sloan Roach, and my mom's brother Benjamin changed to Andre, who had a very successful beauty shop in Hollywood. He found a job in a machine shop, probably tied to the war effort. We lived at 2405 West 73rd Street in Louisiana during the war until we moved to Missouri in the spring of 1945. I remember the night that they thought there were Japanese airplanes over LA and we stood at our front window and saw the searchlights on the sky and we were firing live anti-aircraft guns. While I was a month shy of being 4 years old, I had a sense how serious this was. I'm pretty sure we lived in a duplex. We adopted my first dog Tippy from the LA Dog Pound and I began kindergarten and first grade at the 74th St. Grade School. We would visit my dad's sister and her husband and my mom's brother. Most everything was rationed: gas, meat, tires, etc. So we did not travel too much. When my dad's brother became a paratrooper, we took in his daughter Linda, as he and his wife had divorced and she did not want Linda. We all loved her as if she was our own. My memories of those years are good, except I did have a strong sense of the war, especially when we would go to the beach and see the gun emplacements and the barrage balloons. When our visit from LA to see my mom's dad, in Columbia, MO, my dad's life changed for the better, as it did for all of us. When my dad followed us to MO, he sold all of our possessions and came to MO with our essential family items and Tippy. Among my toys was a wood Superman figure, which I would love to have today. Superman was created in 1938, the year I was born, and was my superhero. For collectors it would be quite valuable today. When my dad arrived in Columbia, he found a job back in the grocery business, but fortunately a job opportunity would come along that would define the rest of his life. The job my dad would obtain would lead to a career and his eventual ownership of the business called Wolcott Water Softeners. It became the largest water softening business in Columbia with a presence in Fulton, MO. My dad was about 5 feet 11 inches, blonde hair, barrel chested, and never overweight. A smoker most of his life, I believe that his smoking led to emphysema and his death at age 77, just about 2 weeks before his 78th birthday. He died on November 22, 1985. He was totally honest, politically astute, and had a great work ethic. He was somewhat of an introvert until he took the Dale Carnegie course, and then he blossomed as a speaker and his increased self-confidence was very noticeable. He traveled many miles, sat on a lot of bleacher seats as he watched me play FB, BB, baseball, and track from grade school through college. probably one of his most satisfying moment in my sports endeavors was during my senior year at Missouri when we beat Michigan at Michigan with 2 seconds left on the clock. A lot of my dad's sisters and their family lived in Michigan and came to that game. Great win, in front of the family. Unfortunately, my dad died in Columbia before I could fly back from California to see him. He and I loved to play Scrabble and cribbage against each other. Had some great arguments about the use of certain words before there was an official Scrabble dictionary. One of my fondest memories was the times we would play last tag. He would tag me, rush to the car, and as he departed he was trying to roll up his car window before I could reach him to tag him back. Years after his death I saw the perfect cartoon. It showed a father on his deathbed with his son at his side. Suddenly the father tagged his son by his side, uttered two last tag two and then died. I then knew that some other father slash son had the same experience as my dad and I. I was very fortunate to have the dad that I did. My parents were opposites in many ways and would have some dandy arguments, but were always encouraging of my efforts and ambitions. My sister, Thonetta Toni Laureen Sloan. My parents adopted Toni when she was 6 weeks old through the Lutheran home in St. Louis, MO. Know how devastated they were when my dad's brother reclaimed his daughter Linda after WW2. Their expectation was that we would raise Linda. Toni was born June 30, 1949 and died on July 1, 2011. I played a big role in her early years, especially when my mom and dad were building our house. I made her formula, fed her, changed her diapers. I was Mr. Mom during those early years. Since there was an 11-year gap in our age, I did not continue to grow up with her under the same roof. She was a good girl growing up, and as she got older I was now out of the house and on my own. My dad probably spoiled her, causing a slight degree of friction between my mom and dad. I was 22 and married when she was 11, so I lost the regular contact that we had in her earlier years. All of us loved her as we did Linda when we were all together. She graduated from Hickman and Stevens College in Columbia with a 2-year degree. She married a really nice guy named Dennis Gabriel, who had a musical talent and was an excellent piano tuner. They moved to the Kansas City area and had 2 boys, Scott and Van. When Peg and our family left for California in 1979, we pretty well lost communication with her and her family. The last time I saw her was at my mom's funeral in 1987. My dad had died in 1985, and the relationship between my mom and Toni had deteriorated, and not sure of all of the reasons. During my mom's final few days in hospice before her death, Peg and our daughter Lori were by her side until I was able to join them from California. Toni would come over during the lunch hour to give Peg and Lori a break and eat my mom's lunch, since my mom was under heavy sedation. After the funeral we went our separate ways, and I only learned of her death well after the fact. Our oldest son, Douglas Taft Sloan. Our oldest son Doug arrived on September 18, 1960, 9 months and 14 days after we were married. I was born 9 months and 9 days after my parents were married. Couldn't break their record. Doug weighed 8 pounds, 12 ounces, and became one of the most handsome baby boys you could imagine. Peg's aunt Sadie entered him in 2 baby contests, and he won both Boone County Fair and again in Centralia, MO. After his second win in Centralia, he asked Peg, "Well, did I win again?" That ended his baby contest days. Doug was named after General Douglas MacArthur and Ohio Senator Robert A. Taft, known as Mr. Conservative within the Republican Party. He was a man of immense integrity. From the day of his birth, Doug was the most organized little kid I've ever seen. Even the few times he did something wrong, it was organized. We had a set of encyclopedias of 20 books. Probably, around age 2, he put a little 1-inch purple crayon mark on the top of each book, about the same location and size on each book. During his first year, Peggy's Aunt Sadie kept him during the day while Peg was working. Aunt Sadie was so proud of him, she took him to every friend she had to show him off. When you walked with him down the street, people would constantly stop and comment on what a handsome baby boy he was. In our first apartment after he was born, his crib was adjacent to our bed in our one-bedroom APT. Early in the morning, Peg and I learned to just peek at him as if he saw any activity, it was all over. As long as he thought we were sleeping, he would stand at his crib with his eyes focused on us, very quietly waiting for a sign of life. It was in this app that he learned to walk. First around our coffee table at 5 months and then alone at 6 months. Very early walker. Aunt Sadie was a big part of his life while we were in Colombia, and they formed a lifelong bond. Sadie loved our other two kids, but she had helped raise Doug, and that was the difference. When we moved from Colombia to Higginsville, MO for my first head FB coaching job, one day Doug and our dog, Saben, a Norwegian elk hound, decided to go downtown at about age 3. Peg caught him before he went out of sight. From Higginsville we moved to Centralia and then Carthage, MO, where he started kindergarten. Carthage had no public kindergarten, so we sent him to the Catholic kindergarten run by Sister Vincent, a remarkable nun and teacher. We could tell that she had a special feeling about Doug. Doug was a quick learner, could memorize, and always played the lead role in any program for the parents. One of the more memorable aspects about his kindergarten time occurred during his walk to and from school, which was a pretty good distance. Couldn't do it today. Doug would come home from school and talk about the little girl he met on the way, as they both were headed to the same school. He would describe in detail what she wore, day after day. Only when it was raining very hard one day when Peg went to pick him up did she see that the little girl he described daily was black. He never saw her color as a factor in describing her. We thought to ourselves, how great it would be if that color blindness existed nationwide. Because Doug was born on the 18th of September, he could either be among the youngest in his class or the oldest. We decided that for a boy, it would be best if he was among the oldest, so we had him repeat kindergarten to achieve that goal. This meant that now Doug and Matt were both in kindergarten together. For years Matt claimed that Doug flunked kindergarten. Brotherly love. Doug was always a very good student, and one of the happiest days in my life is when he could read. I'd have him read the instructions to assemble the swing set and then I'd tighten the nuts. He had the patience and understanding of wading through vaguely written instructions that I never had. One of his happiest moments was in Kirksville, MO, when we gave him an old washing machine and some wrenches. Boy, was he a happy kid. When we moved to Jeff City, MO, Doug's interest in athletics began to blossom. He played catcher in baseball and did very well. He also played FB for a year 8th grade, I think, and was impressive. But there was a very good track coach who got him interested in track and running. He was the most dedicated 8th grader I'd seen. He would run to school in the morning about 5 miles regardless of the weather and then work out after school. He desperately wanted to make it to the Olympics. I can say he had the heart and dedication of an Olympian. As he got older, less dedicated kids with more natural ability began to surpass him. He eventually recognized this and told his mom that his role would be to help the younger kids get better. Years later, as a father of two boys, Doug became as good a little league baseball coach as I've seen. You could have paid Doug $1 million and he would not have done a better coaching job. Doug ran a couple of marathons. In the first one he started too quickly, didn't take enough liquids, and it was cool. As the race progressed and it got hotter, Doug's muscles began to seriously cramp. Near the finish line it took all of his willpower to finish in great agony. It was a display of immense personal determination and dedication. That race defined his intensity. When we moved from Cape Girardeau, MO in 1979, Doug had just graduated from HS. He went to Fresno ST for a semester before returning to Missouri to attend Southeast MO. ST, where I had served as athletic director before accepting the job with Fresno ST. When he started at Fresno ST, he found that he was a year ahead of what was being taught, plus his friends were in Missouri. It was a more costly move for him, but it worked out for his undergraduate degree at MO and then getting his law degree at the University of MO at Kansas City, UMKC. We were of little financial help to him once he returned to Missouri, as we felt that the added expense was due to his choice, as he could have continued at Fresno St. for very little money. We did get him a leased Chevrolet Sprint his last 2 years to get him off motorcycles, which scared us to death. Think he got the fifth Sprint shipped to America. It got up to 60 miles per gallon on the highway and 50 around town. A great little car. He added cruise control and some other goodies. Doug graduated with honors at SMO and then was off to law school at UMKC. He put himself through law school and began his career at a large firm in downtown KC overlooking the MO River. He helped win a huge lawsuit involving formaldehyde in sheetrock when he uncovered an internal corporate memo the danger within the sheetrock. His firm won the case, a big one due in large part to Doug's research. He was briefly married to a school teacher in the KC area. Her mom and dad were getting a divorce and Doug wound up representing her father. Think that was a mistake, as Doug discovered the flaw of the wife, which he also saw in his wife. Fortunately, they had no kids. Doug had told Peggy that he would never divorce if children were involved. Doug was an attorney in the family law firm of Rush Limbaugh, America's most listened to talk show host. In the firm at one time was Rush's grandfather, his dad and his brother. Doug was interviewed by the grandfather, who was 100 and had practiced law for 80 years. The oldest practicing attorney in America. Think he died at about 104. Doug, after his divorce, returned to Fresno, as the girl he dated in Fresno, Janet, had also experienced a divorce, and the two reconnected via the internet. They married and were blessed with two boys, Luke and Ryan, who are exact carbon copies of our two. Luke is just like Doug and Ryan is just like our Matt. It is like watching your sons reborn. Amazing replication of genetics. Doug is the city attorney for Fresno, the fourth largest city in California. Quite an achievement. Janet is also very accomplished and has been in public education for 30 plus years in the classroom, as well as her current county administrative duties. As of 11 December 2016. Matthew Edward Sloan. Matthew Edward Sloan was named after two people. The Matt came from Matt Flynn, a year ahead of me at Hickman and the funniest kid in school. He looked a lot like Dick Van Dyke, one of the funniest men in America on TV and in the movies. You could not help but like Matt Flynn. The Edward came from Peg's uncle Ed, who raised Peg from age 4 along with Aunt Sadie, sister of Peg's mom. Uncle Ed Laster was a cable splicer with the telephone company in Columbia and one of the finest men on this earth. Matt was born on July 18, 1962 at Boone County Hospital, Columbia, MO. He weighed in at 10 pounds, 4 ounces. Peg's doctor, Dr. C, said Matt was the second biggest baby he had delivered from someone Peg's size. He was huge, blonde-headed, and they put him in the parental viewing area by a set of twins who weighed 4.5 pounds apiece. Looked like King Kong next to a pygmy. On his stomach, he could raise his head off the bed and look to his left and right. He was 6 weeks old when we moved from Columbia to Higginsville, as I had become the new head FB coach. We have some short film footage of Matt and Doug at that time, in Higginsville. Matt was a great baby, but far different than Doug. Doug walked at 6 months, Matt at 14 months. We thought something was wrong. Peg took him to the doctor, and the doctor said, he's fine and will walk when he wants to. He was right. Matt definitely resembled my side of the family. Doug favored Peg's side, and Lori, yet to arrive, would be a mix of Peg and myself. Matt loved to play games and was very outgoing. Both Doug and Matt were very competitive, but far different in personality. Doug was Mr. Organized and Matt was Mr. Spontaneous. Both were good students. Matt started kindergarten in Carthage, MO, as Doug had done at the Catholic kindergarten with Sister Vincent. When we moved from Carthage to Kirksville, 1968, he was 6 years old and began the first grade in Kirksville. Matt hated the cold winters of Kayville. Peg would bundle him up and send him out to play. In a short time he was back at the front door, wanting to come back inside where it was warm. Matt and Doug would occasionally come to FB practice when I was head FB coach at No. East MO. ST. University. Now Truman ST. We have some memorable photos of the boys and the blocking dummies. When we moved from Kayville to Jeff City in early 1973, Matt was 11 and a half and was now becoming a Jeff City Jay. The Jays were the arch rivals of my HS and it was a great personal challenge to root for the Jays. Matt had a lot of natural athletic ability and played summer league baseball and began his FB playing days when Pete Atkins was the head HS. FB coach and a legend in Missouri HS ranks, having won 71 games in a row. The streak was stopped by my HS. The Hickman QBs. Matt was not old enough to play at the varsity level, but the entire FB program from the 7th grade on was organized by Coach Atkins. He was exposed to one of the finest H.S. FB programs in America. Matt had many friends and continued to do well in school. However, one day Peg was driving in Jeff City during school hours and saw Matt with a group of his buddies skipping school. When Matt saw his mom, he instantly knew he was in deep trouble. Peg took him to the principal's office. The principal was a former QB who we knew, and Peg told the principal to issue whatever punishment he thought was needed. I think he banned Matt from 2 weeks of playing baseball, which did the trick. We moved to Cape Girardeau in 1977 when I became AD at Southeast MO. ST. University. At Cape, Matt blossomed in FB, track, pole vault and wrestling. He spent his sophomore and junior at Cape, but in 1979 we moved to Fresno, CA, as I became the exec. DIR of the Bulldog Foundation for Fresno ST. University. We really hated to have to move with Matt going into his senior year and well established athletically. His track coach was willing to have Matt live with him to spend his senior year in Cape, but due to some of the legal rights we would have to assign to him, we decided against it. Our move to Fresno was initially tough on Matt in FB, as he had to beat out an established starter. Being the new kid on the team, he did not play much until the starter got hurt, and Matt did such a good job the starter was never able to beat him out. Matt went to Hoover HS, and following FB he went into wrestling and excelled. His wrestling style included a lot more use of his legs, which initially the officials did not fully understand. Finally, Matt's wrestling coach educated the officials and Matt had a great season. I'll always remember, at Thanksgiving dinner, having Matt sit at the table, sucking on ice cubes in order to make weight. That took immense willpower. Following wrestling, he was on to track and pole vaulting. In 3 years of HS. FB, no injuries, but in 3 years of wrestling he broke a bone each year. He was a good enough wrestler to receive a wrestling scholarship offer from Fresno ST. But he wanted to return to Missouri and go to Central MO. ST. University in Warrensburg, MO. He graduated with a dual major in finance and business. Matt worked his way through college, as did Doug. He had learned enough of construction during our home building effort in Jeff City to earn the necessary money doing carpentry work in Warrensburg. I think it was important for Matt's success in college for him to take the responsibility to put himself through school. It would have been far cheaper for both Doug and Matt to have gone to college at Fresno ST, and if they wanted to return to Missouri to go to school, then the financial burden shifted to them. Both boys were on motorcycles in MO, which did scare us to death. In fact, Matt did have one pretty hairy experience when he hit loose gravel and got scraped up pretty good. At that point we leased 2 Chevy Sprints for both boys. The Sprint got 50 plus miles to a gallon, had 4 doors, fold-down backseat with a 3-cycle Suzuki engine. We later got one ourselves, as a second car, and they were amazing little cars. I remember one situation when Matt was seeking a summer job. There was a big construction project in San Diego and Matt applied. He was told that they were only hiring journeymen to work. Matt did not have that title, but he told the project manager, "Let me work a week for you. If you like my work, hire me, and if you don't, you don't have to pay me." He got the job. I believe I could have sent Matt anywhere in the world and within a week he would have found a job. After college graduation, I think Matt worked for a bank for a while but quickly decided that sitting in an office behind a desk was not appealing to him. He liked to build things. His career thereafter was filled with development of major construction projects. I was amazed on the scale of some of the projects he oversaw for his age. Matt had the skill that he was at ease with a millionaire financial backer or the hod carrier on the construction site. At the time of this entry, Matt is now 53 and working on projects in Portland, Oregon. He and his wife Carolyn, now divorced, had two boys, Matt and Jordan. Both boys live in Oregon. I won't list all of the various projects that Matt accomplished, but it is impressive. He has shown to have great skills and a tremendous work ethic. He has had the misfortune that some of his big and successful projects hit the national marketplace at the wrong time. That was heartbreaking. But he doesn't give up and always bounces back. Both Doug and Matt were not close growing up, so different, but have become very close as adults. In both boys, the tenacity they showed as student athletes carried forth in their professional careers. Lori Ellen Sloan. Lori was our third child and, like the first two, was also born on the 18th of the month, true Planned Parenthood. She was a March baby born in Boone County Hospital in Columbia, MO. 1966, although we lived in Carthage. Peg felt more comfortable with her regular doctor, Dr. William C. in Columbia. Because Matt weighed 10 pounds and 4 ounces, Drive C induced Lori 2 weeks early to avoid Peg having another 10-pound-plus baby. As it was, she weighed 7-plus pounds. Our two boys were born with a full head of hair, and naturally our daughter was born almost hairless. Lori would spend her first 2 years in Carthage before we moved to Kirksville, MO, as I became the line coach at NEMO. ST. University. Lori was always more of a tomboy. In fact, one night as she was getting ready for bed, Peg was putting her to bed and wanting Lori to put her nightgown on. Lori wanted to wear pajamas like the boys and decided that she would go across the street to Don and Connie Hiskey's house because they had two boys, she wanted to be a boy and they liked boys. As she headed out the door, Peg called Connie and filled her in. Lori arrived at the Hiskey's. Was told they had no extra pajamas, and she walked back across the street, put on her nightgown and went to bed with no more said. Lori was a mix of Peg and myself. Beautiful and loving little girl. One of our favorite pictures was taken by the Kirksville newspaper prior to the start of school. It is framed and on our bedside. On several occasions, the boys and Lori would come to the FB fields during practice and they enjoyed the action. Doug and Matt would block the dummies and, again, one of our favorite photos is the boys blocking a dummy bag. One tragic experience occurred when Lori, probably age 4 or 5, came home in tears when she was in the locker room, passing out towels, and some player yelled, "Get that girl out of here." Broke her heart. Ours, also. One of those difficult experiences that life deals us all, in one way or the other. In 1973 we moved from Kayville to Jeff City as I was named the new director of motor vehicles and licensing for the state of Missouri in the first term of Gov. Kit Bond. Lori was almost 7 and spent her early school years there. In one teacher conference Peg had Lori, the teacher noted that when Lori finished her assignment she would start visiting with those close to her. The teacher said she then moved Lori up close to her desk and then shared that now when Lori finishes her work early, she now talks to her and she can't get her work done. Lori was always outgoing and friendly. She loved her sports opportunities, and when she was probably around age 9 or 10 there was a national free throw shooting contest that began at the local level and progressed to the national finalists. We took Lori to the local competition and she finished runner-up to the first place girl. As we were driving home, she asked us, "What does runner-up mean?" We explained that if the first place girl got sick and couldn't go to the next level, then Lori would go in her place. After our explanation sunk in, Lori burst out in tears and said, "I hope she gets sick." Another difficult lesson of life. In 1977 we moved to Cape Girardeau as I became the AD for SEMO. ST. We were there 2 years. When I took the job in Fresno, as DIR of the Bulldog Foundation, I wanted to get into DIV. I athletics, and this was a good entry point. Arriving in Fresno in 1979, all of our kids were a good year ahead of the California kids in schoolwork. Lori was in junior HS and they bussed her across town to a school primarily filled with kids that did not have the parental support or expectations that we had and that Lori was accustomed to in Missouri. Lori was always one to try to help people, and she found herself being sucked into a culture unfamiliar to her. She sympathized with a lot of the kids that kind of did their own thing and had minimal parental supervision. She went through a trying time for her and us. She was never disrespectful to us or belligerent, but she was staying out all night with kids who were used to living this way. Finally, Peg and I had a major decision to make. We needed to have her obey our rules or move out. When she again stayed out all night, Peg packed her bags, she was 14, and set them on the outside of our front door. For about 3 weeks we did not see or hear from her and prayed that we had made the right decision, as well as prayers for her welfare. Then one night Peg gets a call from the mother of one of the kids where Lori was staying. Lori was really sick and the woman was concerned. We went and picked her up. Everything she had in the suitcases had been stolen. When she recovered, her life returned to the Lori pre-California and returned to her normal life within our family. Perhaps we were just lucky, but in this case our tough love decision worked. Most difficult decision in our life, but changed Lori's life for the better from then on. Thereafter, could not have had a better daughter. We then enrolled Lori in Fresno Christian School and she thrived in both school and sports her junior and senior year. It was a great fit. She excelled in basketball and softball, although early on in basketball, she stole the ball, got turned around and headed toward her opponent's basket. She shot and missed and her own fans cheered. Boy, was she embarrassed. In softball her senior year she made her greatest play. She was catcher and I had taught her how to defend the plate if she had the ball and an incoming player was trying to score by running over her. I showed her how to get low and come up under the runner, denying them the plate. As fate would have it, Lori's team was playing against a team that had a really large, intimidating girl who did run over the catcher if possible. Well, in this game the exact situation arose when Lori had the ball and the big girl attempted to run over her and jar loose the ball. Lori got low, came up under the girl and flipped her past the plate, and the umpire rightfully called her out. The big girl was now flat on the ground, crying, as I'm sure this is probably the first time she had failed to bully her opponent. The other team manager came running out of the dugout to complain, and the umpire repeats out, stating, "The plate belongs to the catcher as long as she has the ball." After that call, Lori took off her mask, looked into the crowd and flashed a big smile to Peg, knowing she had stood her ground and did exactly what she had been taught. Lori was tough then and still is. After graduation from Fresno Christian, Lori had met a guy at People's Church, sponsor of Fresno Christian School, named Russell Obichan, who was 9 years older than Lori. One night Russell and Lori came to tell us they wanted to get married. I went to the garage, I brought back a ladder, my hint for an elopement, but Russell, being a Californian used to one-story homes, missed the point of the ladder and elopement. The wedding was held at People's Church with the reception at our home. Russell was a maintenance engineer at a local large bread-making plant and often had the late shift at the plant. We tried to be very fair-minded about Lori getting married at 18, as Peg was 18 when we got married. Not long into their marriage we saw signs that Russell had a temper, was controlling and moody. Lori, ever the one to help people, I'm sure felt that she was filling a void in Russell's life and constantly bent over backwards to be a great wife. 2 years after their marriage their first child arrived, Allison, who was one of the most enjoyable little kids I ever been around. She was an early talker, complete sentences, and very aware of events around her. After Allison came Christina, then Jessica, followed by Daniel. All of the kids had dark hair, as did Russell and Lori, except Christy, who was blonde and looked almost exactly like the picture of my mom's Aunt Emma. I had nicknames for the three girls. Allison was Duty Foots, Christy was Hambone and Jessica was Sweetie Pie. A must for all four grandkids was to learn and remember my college FB number, number 84. I believe that they will remember that for the rest of their life. Mission accomplished. Both Russell and Lori were heavily involved in People's Church, which eventually led to Lori becoming very involved in reaching young people via a worldwide ministry program called Kids EE. She was excellent in her role but also had to raise the bulk of her salary in addition to ministering to kids and sharing the program with other churches throughout the country. Peg and I had moved from Fresno in 1989 as I took on the presidency of the Muncie, Delaware County Chamber of Commerce. Allison was a little over two and it was difficult leaving Lori and her family behind. After we left Fresno, Russell and Lori bought a plot of ground east of Fresno and built a house, largely based on Russell's skill. It turned out very nice. At this time Lori also got into training horses, primarily Arabians, and was very skilled at doing this. She had a real gift. Over the years that we were away from Fresno, it never failed that when we would return for a visit that we would always see some evidence of Russell's moody behavior. If he was playing with any of the kids, tickling them, he would never stop until the laughing turned to tears. Whether it was actions like this, a hateful look or a demeaning comment, we kept our mouth shut and watched Lori try to heal the wounds and keep a household together. Finally, after 28 years of living under a controlling husband, Lori had finally had enough and filed for divorce. While Russell cried poor me at their church, Lori refrained from bad-mouthing Russell. The church, strongly anti-divorce, had no concept of what Lori and the kids had gone through and the very negative impact Russell had on their four kids. A couple of years after her divorce, Lori met a man, Jared Quant, whose life had been in AG and was now in AG Real Estate. Outstanding choice, they worked together, utilized each other's strengths, and found that they had a strong, mutual bond. They married in 2015, and it was the second marriage for both. They reside in Fresno and are in business together. As of this entry, Lori is now 49 and physically working out to a degree that I expect that at 49 she probably would be in the top 1% of physical fitness among women her age in America. Update follows. She is now 50. November 12, 2016. Lori has been a very loving, a caring daughter, great mom, multi-talented, a committed Christian and tenacious. We have been blessed with three great kids, all different, all accomplished and all have overcome challenges to be where they are in life. She is now into powerlifting and the family microgreens business. Peggy DeFane Fisher Sloan. Peggy DeFane Fisher was born November 30, 41, a week before Pearl Harbor. I suspect her birth of starting World War II. She was the 12th of 13 kids born on the farm in Friendship, 10. Her father died when she was only 4 and her mom's sister Sadie came to the funeral and a decision was made that Peg return on the train to be raised by her Aunt Sadie and her husband Ed Laster, as they had no children. Ed was a cable splicer for the telephone company and one of the finest men who ever lived. Sadie was equally a remarkable person who lost both parents to a Mississippi flood when she was age 5. She was raised by her aunt and was now raising Peg under similar circumstances. Both Ed and Sadie could not have loved Peg more than their own child and under the tragic circumstances were wonderful guardians of Peg as she grew up in Columbia. Because Peg went to school with her brothers and sisters at an early age, she arrived in Columbia at age 4 being able to read and write. Normally she would not start school until a year later but started at Ridgeway Grade School and was among the youngest in her class but ahead of them academically. She started on piano in grade school, took lessons, and excelled. She definitely had a natural music ability which would lead to also playing the clarinet and violin. They lived on Washington right behind the football stadium at Hickman. As a result, she could walk to Ridgeway, Jeff Jr., Hickman, and Christian College, now Columbia College. Peg was always short, as was most of her brothers and sisters, and was 5 tall and 96 pounds when we got married. She claims she was a half inch taller than her mom. While short, she was tough, due to the number of older brothers who made her tougher to hold her own. After the piano, she began the clarinet and later the violin at the request of Leo Behrens, the band instructor at Hickman, who wanted to start an orchestra and needed more violinists. Mr. Behrens was a tremendous teacher and was a huge influence on Peg's musical development. Peg also excelled in typing and was the fastest typist in high school. Peg was selected as the spring hop queen in her senior year. In her junior year, she was the junior attendant for homecoming and also selected as queen for the junior jamboree. Great photo in her yearbook. S. She was also the majorette for Hickman's marching band and she taught twirling in the summers. At Hickman, she worked Friday nights and Saturday A.R. Woolworth's Five and Dime store on Broadway in Columbia. When she was put in charge of the candy and fresh nut counter, she asked her boss if she could eat any. The boss said, "Yes, but then I'd have to fire you." After her Friday night shift, Uncle Ed would pick her up and she always purchased a sack of candy corn mixed with fresh roasted peanuts to give to him, which he dearly loved. One of many fond memories of Peg's was when she was in grade school and she and Uncle Ed would go to the Buggy Boone Theater to watch cowboy movies and the Saturday morning serials. They were also the first in their neighborhood to get a TV, which would attract all the neighbors to come watch their favorite program. Peg told me that in the 14 years she lived with Ed and Sadie, she never heard them argue one time. Ed was in charge of the money and Sadie was in charge of the home. Ed did not believe in credit accounts and paid cash for everything. He bought a new car every 10 years and paid cash. The home they were in was purchased in two payments, $1,000 when they bought it and the second $1,000 a year later to pay it off. Peg said she was never at home one night alone. Sadie was strict but fair and always so practical. On Christmas she would get one nice present and the same for Sadie and Ed. On her birthday she would get her favorite pie, as Sadie was big on pies but not cakes. She was an excellent cook, but never let Peg cook. Peg was taught to always make her bed right after she got up and that habit continued through our marriage. Each summer when Ed took his vacation they would drive to Tennessee to spend time with Peg's mom and siblings. She has many pleasant memories when visiting the farm. She also retains a scar above her ankle when she and her youngest brother before her dad's death were hoeing the garden and her brother Tootsie accidentally chopped his ankle. As she was bleeding, her mom got some kerosene and poured it on the wound to sterilize it. It really burned and as Peg started to cry, her mom told her to stop or she'd give her a spanking for crying. Her mom had the first 12 kids at home and the 13th was delivered outside the house. Peg has but two memories of her dad. The first was when her mom had a switch and was after her for some misbehavior and her dad was laughing and kept Peg behind him so her mom couldn't get to her. The second memory was at her dad's funeral when all the kids gave him a kiss goodbye in his coffin. My first exposure to Peg was via the Columbia Daily Tribune. There was a picture showing her in a full-length pose looking into a full-length mirror. Something within me instantly clicked and I knew right away I needed to meet her. We still have that picture. It was a beautiful photo. I cannot remember how I first contacted her in early summer, but when I did, I was allowed to see her at home, swinging on their front porch swing. I was going into my senior year at Missouri and Peg was going into her first year at Christian College just a few blocks from her home. Sadie was afraid of our age difference 3 years and told Peg that if we started dating we'd wind up getting married. She was right. We swung on that front porch many times before Sadie allowed Peg to join me and my dad, who was driving me to Mexico, MO, to play a Ben Johnson baseball game. Because my dad was along, Peg could come to the game. At my first time at bat, I did a bit of hot dogging, Babe Ruth style, and with my bat pointed at dead center field. I then hit the greatest home run in my life, dead center field some 400 plus. Peg said my dad just shook his head. My second at bat, I homered to right center field. This was a more towering drive but not as far as the first one. After the first homer, an elderly fan came up to the fence between the dugout and the stands and told me that in all the years he had seen games played in that park, he never saw a home run of that distance. All I can say, is that it was meant to be. Peg still claims that those two home runs had no effect on her, but I choose to believe that it did. Even Babe Ruth would have been proud of that first one. I was working that summer for the State Highway Department. We were surveying the path for Interstate 70 through Columbia. This was one of the earliest legs of the great interstate system. I'm not sure during the summer when I came to the realization that I wanted to marry Peg, but I started saving my summer earnings for an engagement ring. Sadie had finally allowed us to go to a movie and attend the home Tiger FB games because I was playing. Most all of my summer earnings did go to that ring, and when I proposed, fortunately she accepted. I hoped we would marry after my senior year, but our good football fortunes and the Orange Bowl bid would accelerate our plans. When we beat Kansas in our final game at Kansas, we got the Orange Bowl bid. In previous years, I watched Oklahoma go to the Orange Bowl on a frequent basis, and I read that several of the players who were married took their wives. It was a spur-of-the-moment decision, but I went to see our head FB coach, Dan Devine, and asked him that if Peg and I got married, could she go to the Orange Bowl as part of the Missouri group? He thought for a moment and then said, "Okay, just do it as soon as you can." We put our wedding together in 4 days. We got married on a Friday night at 7 p.m. in Wilkes Boulevard Methodist Church. Both of our ministers were involved. Pep's was Rev. Longstreth and mine was Pastor Nidenthal, Lutheran. Because we had FB practice that afternoon, I had put my two front teeth partial bridge in my locker during practice. I lost those two teeth my freshman year when Larry Plum, a senior, and gave me a deliberate elbow to the mouth. This was the last year before face guards and mouthpieces. Plum was the only really dirty player on the team. In fact, in the next year when Coach Broyles was at Missouri, he finally told Plum that if he saw Plum holding or clipping one more time, he'd kick him off the team. Well, sometime after practice while we were showering, one of my teammates took my teeth out of the locker. "So I'm going to get married in a few hours, missing two of my teeth." As we all got ready for the wedding, I'm about to go down the aisle and my teammate Bob Haas, a talented QB and DEF back, handed me my teeth. Saved. Haas would later marry a beautiful classmate of Peg's named Judy Hutchinson. Dale Pidcock, my roommate my senior year at Mizzou, was my best man. He also was an end, and the other two best men were Bob Haas and Tom Watson, my best buddy in high school. We were both all-conference forwards on Hickman's basketball team. A married couple from Peg's class, Jim and Betty Baldwin, gave up their home for Peg and I to spend our one-night honeymoon there, as I had FB practice at 8 a.m. the next morning. When I arrived for practice, no one had yet dressed out in their practice gear, and they gave me a standing ovation. After practice, as Coach Devine lined us up for sprints, he smiled at me and said, "Russ, you don't have to run." The team and coaching staff gave Peg and I a beautiful engraved silver tea service and tray. We married on December 4th, 4 days after Peg's 18th birthday. Because Christian was an all-girls college, they did not then allow married girls to attend, so she had to leave Christian. As I have reflected back on that, I regret that she had to do that. Peg was so good in music that Missouri had offered her a music scholarship to attend MU, but Sadie and Ed had put money into Christian for her to go there for several years, so Peg had to pass up the Missouri scholarship. The Orange Bowl was now less than a month away, but we were now a married couple and Peg was now going to work to supplement my full scholarship. After we beat Kansas for the Orange Bowl bid, I received word that I was also invited to play in the Hula Bowl the week after the Orange Bowl. The game would be played in Honolulu. I had been selected as an All-Big 8 end and knew that I was likely to be drafted by the new American FB League or the older National FB League. We flew from St. Louis to Miami on Christmas Day to get ready for the Orange Bowl. This was Peg's first flight. We stayed at the Ivanhoe Hotel on Miami Beach. But with two-a-day practices, the only time I got to spend much time with Peg was at night and some of the Orange Bowl events we attended. It was a fun week, but our main focus was on beating Georgia and Fran Tarkenton and their great QB, who would go on to a Hoff career in the NFL with the Minnesota Vikings. On game day, we outplayed Georgia statistically, but Tarkenton was the difference. They beat us 14-0. I caught 6 passes, which was a Missouri Bowl game reception record that stood for 43 years, and I barely got tripped up on Georgia's 11-yard line heading for a TD. That night my left shoulder became very painful as I had partially dislocated my clavicle bone from my sternum. During the heat of the game I had no pain, but that night the soreness really set in. The next morning, however, I was headed to Hawaii with teammate Mike Magic, RRT. Tackle, who was the number 2 draft choice for the San Francisco 49ers. Peg stayed behind and flew back with the team to snowy Missouri. Not until I got to Hawaii did I learn that I could have brought Peg with me in lieu of the $100 expense money given to all the single players. When I got the Hula Bowl invitation, I was single and therefore was not made aware of the married players' option to take their wives. I came back and told her, instead of taking that revelation to my grave. I won't cover our 55 plus years together as of September 7, 2015 in specific detail, job by job or city by city, but will share some of the highlights. Peg's great typing skills got her a typing job at MFA Insurance in Columbia as I was finishing my degree. But our first son Doug was due 9 months and 14 days after we were married, and in those days a pregnant woman at MFA had to quit at the 5-month mark. That summer I headed to training camp in Durham, New Hampshire with the New York Titans, now New York Jets, and Peg moved back to stay with Sadie and Ed during this period. My signing bonus of $500 finally arrived and we were paid $100 per exhibition game, which I sent home as most all of our other expenses were paid. While I was the starting tight end in the exhibition, I had pulled my right hamstring 3 times, very severely, and I knew the team could not begin the regular season with a tight end with a hamstring pull that wasn't healing. It was a low point in my athletic career as I now knew I was good enough to play pro ball, but the only muscle I had ever pulled proved fatal to my season. I returned to Columbia in time to finish my degree and start my master's degree, and the FB coaches gave me some financial assistance to be a grad assistant to the freshman team. Doug was born on the 18th of September, and his 9-month 14 days entry into the world could not beat my 9-month 9-day delivery time. After my parents were married, Peg worked at the Ellis Fischel Cancer Hospital in Columbia during my school time before I got my first teaching and coaching job at Hickman H.S. 1961-62. Matt was born in 62 and Lori arrived in 66. Peg was a full-time mom in Higginsville, Centralia, and Kirksville. She did work when I was in Carthage and later in Jeff City. She handled much of the hiring for the MO. Department of Agriculture. Peg was extremely skillful in sifting through resumes and selecting good people. Later she worked in Governor Kit Bond's office, handling his schedule. Gov. Bond had immense respect for Peg. She had tremendous instincts, and I used her skills several times when I was an athletic director and during my 20-year chamber career. Her last job was in Fresno as the assistant to the manager, Don Duncan, for the H.S. Crocker Company, which sold office supplies to businesses and government departments. She was a whiz in that position. In fact, she excelled in any job she ever had. Great work ethic, well organized, quick learner, and totally honest and trustworthy. During my campaign for Congress, she always made a great impression, and when she was asked to speak, she made it clear that I addressed the issues and she addressed what she felt were my strengths. She did not like the speaking engagements, but always did well. Even though I resigned from my coaching job and withdrew all 11 years of my teacher's retirement to live on during the campaign, she never complained and was always supportive. She was a tremendous asset to my campaign. Peg also was an excellent mom. None of our 3 kids ever talked back to us, they had chores and did them, and she was a better athletic coach to our kids, as I was busy coaching other kids as that was my job. She was a good athlete, and now approaching 74 she can outwork ladies 10-15 years younger. She also possesses an exceptional decorating eye. She could take anyone's home and make it look better using their same furniture and accessories. She could easily be a professional decorator. For many years our mutual hobby was collecting antiques. We had a bunch of clocks, soapstone, furniture and double-walled ice water pitchers made between 1854 and 1900. When we quit collecting, we probably had just over 100 ice water pitchers, probably the largest collection in the world. The double wall made it the thermos jug of its day to keep ice water cold for a longer period of time. Peg found the first one in Fresno and the dealer said it was a coffee pot. Only when she bought the second did she find out that they were ice water pitchers, not coffee pots. The pitchers were usually quadruple silver plate and most all were made in New England. Almost all were different because you had your choice of tops, spouts, handles, and body styles. The two biggest makers were Reed and Barton and Meridian. We deliberately bought one look-alike because it was made in St. Louis. The only one we ever saw not made in New England. As a wife, she was a far better wife than I was a husband. I married an exceptional person who really made the best of every situation. I think it was a mutual asset to us that we both grew up in Columbia, went to Hickman and had a background familiar to both of us. She was beautiful with no self-consumed sense of her own beauty. At Christian College she was voted among the 10 best-dressed girls. Most of the girls came from families who were very well off and could buy the clothes to make a good appearance. Most of Peg's clothes were made for her by Aunt Sadie, who was outstanding in making Peg's clothes. What the rich girls didn't know was Peg had her own personal tailor, in Aunt Sadie. Peg was 5 tall and weighed 96 pounds when we got married. Doug was born at 8 pounds, 12 ounces, and coming out of the hospital you'd never know she just had a baby. She remains petite to this day and is still beautiful. She has been blessed with good health for most all of her life and only recently had a problem with acid reflux which had caused some scarring buildup at the base of her esophagus and reduced the opening to her stomach from the size of a quarter to that of a dime. She did have some recent outpatient surgery work done which expanded that opening from a dime to a nickel. Now taking a pill for the acid reflux and see if it works or if she has to go back for the expansion of the opening. Peg is a lover of crossword puzzles and although she hates computers she plays a number of the free games available on the iNet. After 55 plus years with Peg, I have come to the conclusion that there is few things she could not accomplish, once she set her mind to it. When she volunteered at the Pinellas County SPCA she was chosen as the Volunteer of the Year and was superb in handling animals. As a volunteer in Sun City Center she drove the city on an assigned route as part of the community patrol and in a couple years was chosen as an officer on their board. She never did anything halfway. She always excelled. Peg and I were raised very differently but saw eye to eye most times in raising our kids, buying homes, politically, religiously and most other decisions that we faced. There is a saying, too soon old, too late smart. The older I got, the more I appreciated what a remarkable person I had married. Easily the best decision of my life. It is now November 19, 2016 and coming up soon is Peg's 75th BD and our 57th anniversary.